Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I am your host, Paola Morales, and I am so glad to be here with Dr. H. Eric Schockman, one of the editors of Peace, Reconciliation, and Social Justice, Leadership in the 21st Century, The Role of Leaders and Followers, a 2019 Emerald Publishing book that provides a blueprint by leading world scholars and practitioners in leadership, followership, transitional justice, and international law on how people-led, bottom-up, grassroots efforts can foster reconciliation and a more peaceable world. Dr. Eric Schockman is a public policy expert, a politics and international relations professor, and humanities and center for leadership coordinator at Woodbury University. As well, he is the president and founder of the Global Hunger Foundation, which focuses on assisting women in the developing world break the chain of poverty by funding projects designed to provide sustainable development and organic farming. A link to the Global Hunger Foundation can be found in the episode notes. The co-editors of this book are Vanessa Alexandra Hernandez Soto and Aldo Buitano de Moras. Dr. Eric Schockman, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. And would you mind beginning by saying a few words about yourself, how you became interested in social justice leadership, and how you came to co-write Peace, Reconciliation, and Social Justice Leadership in the 21st Century, The Role of Leaders and Followers?
Sure. Thank you for, again, the introduction and a very gracious introduction, and also for interviewing me. My co-editors also want to express their sincere thanks for this recording and a little about me and how I became interested in social justice work. I started, I think, goes back probably to my stint in the Peace Corps. I dropped out of graduate school and joined the Peace Corps and went to Sierra Leone, West Africa, and I watched the exploitation of the African workers and became acutely aware of the post-colonial realities that the Africans are experiencing. And from there, I came back and started my academic career, which eventually turned into social justice, both in my professional and vocational aspirations. As you introduced, my foundation is also working on a social justice plane, helping to feed women in the developing world. So my life is really dedicated to social justice and equity and peace. And I think that is really the sort of tenor of what I live by.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. And let us now delve into questions on peace, reconciliation, and social justice leadership in the 21st century, the role of leaders and followers. To begin, can you provide the audience a window into you and your co-editor's decision in sectioning the books into the four parts: reconciliation, community building to make, build, and maintain peace, international law and social justice, and the fourth one, peace building?
Sure. So in constructing such an effort to think about how to present the various authors that we approached for this volume, and they were international editors around the globe, we really thought it would be best to sort of introduce the reader in various segments of what we call our buckets of leading towards what peace building ultimately and peace and justice ultimately is designed around. So we started with reconciliation, and then let me take a moment and explain each one of these buckets, if I may. So reconciliation starts with the paradigm that we have a shared and common humanity. And ultimately, it means forgiving that we acknowledge publicly in past wrongs. Reconciliation also takes generations. It's really a complex process when you think about it. It also acknowledges past wrongs leading to structural realignment, and ultimately our memory, I think, as Homo sapiens really is a very, very, very cognizant and important part of our brain. We remember through ceremonial moments, education, myths, etc. So reconciliation really focuses on feelings and relationships between victims and perpetrators. And ultimately, we believe reconciliation leads to a lasting peace. And I just will reference to the listeners about one chapter in this particular section dealing with Pope Francis and Douglas Kramer, who is a colleague of mine at Woodbury, wrote about how Francis, through the concept of mercy, really begins the amends of the abuse of priests against children in the church. So this is the reconciliation, I think, that we see as a beginning part that really leads us down before we can even think about peace, before we can even think about social justice, and we can get more into this later, but it is a priori condition in all societies to be able to ask for forgiveness and move beyond past wrongs and past transgressions and really begin the healing process towards reconciliation. The second bucket, if you may, or the second part, we just labeled community building. And, you know, we really see that peace is not something that's imposed, you know, from top down. Peace is really, to maintain peace especially, it's a ground up, grounding upwards process. You need to ultimately have a community building input to leaders and followers that see ultimately that regional diversity needs a special nuance given the complexities and the importance of peace education on the local level. In this chapter, we deal with diverse cases from Rwanda, Uganda, Sri Lanka, and talk a lot about, you know, these successful peace-building efforts. And I think it also helps to think about the repair and the cracks of the social fabric. And ultimately, community healing is part of the mosaic that, you know, global peace efforts are really, are important and really, that really needs carry forth. And I should parenthetically say the two major foci in this chapter is on the role of women and youth in community building for peace, and that I think we can get in more later as well. So the third bucket, thanks to my co-editor, Vanessa Hernandez, who is an international criminal lawyer with a human rights and criminal law background based in The Hague. We really wanted to talk about international laws and social justice, and in particular, think about addressing some of the root causes of conflict through the international legal system, which began in this, you know, sort of sub area with the Nuremberg trials after World War II, and now has sort of crescendoed on the scene with the international criminal courts. And you know, throughout the structures, I think what we looked at is ultimately international law is really forged that we started in World War II and started in the International Criminal Court is now unraveling. There's been attacks on rule-based order and a rise of populism and destructive leadership that really has, I think, undermined this notion that perpetrators, genocide perpetrators, you know, these rogue outlaws need to be brought to justice. And what we think that is ultimately we need to carve a space for followers to engage in teaching followers how to engage in intelligent disobedience when it comes to following leaders down the wrong path. Women's voices are critical ultimately in the decision-making process in post-healing modality. And I think social justice really has an enduring notion of envisioning inclusiveness, diversity, and civility. In one of the chapters in this section, we deal with the Bosnia-Herzegovina genocide. And as one cannot lead without followers, and one cannot accomplish genocide without obedient followers. So we really... You know, we really take and deconstruct this area, not from a legalistic perspective. I think we didn't want to talk beyond our audience. We wanted this to be a book that is readable and digestible, and sections could be taken out by themselves. But we wanted to not leave this off the table, since this is really a critical part of the mosaic that we thought that really brings ultimately the focus of our last chapter, which is peace building. And we pay tribute really in this chapter to the peacemakers and people who make, who are bridgers of peace. And there's no single way, as we've uncovered, to engage in peace leadership. It's really a collective endeavor. And ultimately, we need followers and leaders to get us there. And we really move into a storytelling of the positive impact and that we see in the field that ultimately gives us hope for the future. So those essentially are the four buckets, four parts of the book, and I think lead a reader towards our hopefully conclusion that peace is a very complex, moving, various sliding entity that ultimately we hope that everyone can be involved with, clearly, but, you know, we can't leave out the future of peace construction in the world. And ultimately, we have to teach peace, and we have to begin somewhere. And we think teaching peace in the universities and in K-12 is the place to begin.
Thank you. That was a perfect overview. And now if we could focus on part one, I was wondering if you could inform our audience how the contents of this section might provide a path for the United States as a whole to bend towards reconciliation through commission, perhaps via was cited by chance and bringing dialogue and reconciliation in the United States around racial issues.
Sure. So, you know, here's the rub of where we're at today. The book was published in 2020, and we feel it was timely for its publication, given the social unrest we see in the streets of cities and rural areas and suburban areas around the country today. Clearly, the Black Lives Matter, the inequity that we've caused in non-recognition of social wrongs. We've committed as a nation atrocities over time. We've been somehow through social amnesia, we've forgot those. And I think our history is starting to come back to haunt us. And, you know, COVID is starting to show the sincere inequalities that we've already created in the health systems, the apartheid housing, et cetera, that has really caused a a disproportional amount of suffering among people of color in this country. So the righteous indignation now we see in the streets, and this is, you know, again, this is 401 year of slavery in the United States, 401. And that number is really astounding when you think about how other countries have, you know, moved past this and really sort of done their social construction of apology, reconciliation, and ultimately moving society beyond the status quo and the and which is unhealthy, and moving a society into a much better place. I just reference in particular the work being done in Canada, in New Zealand. Most of the Commonwealth countries have moved to, you know, apologize for their treatment of their indigenous populations. And it's not that it's they're perfect. It's not that they've solved the enigma of reconciliation, but they've certainly come a lot further than we have. I think I recently heard a comment by Prince Harry that also talked about this notion that, you know, you can't move forward if you don't own up to your wrongs. And really, as a society, for 401 years in the United States, we have never apologized for, you know, bringing slaves into this country, exploiting them, and ultimately making them now African-American second-class citizens. We've done a half step with Japanese-Americans after World War II, where there was reparations that I should mention, minor reparations, $20,000 for the survivors. And the United States really never officially apologized. It gave money to, they threw money at the issue rather than issuing a formal apology by both Congress and the established tentacles of the federal government. So it's astounding that we now have seen, like Alice in the Looking Glass, where, you know, these issues are coming back to haunt us, and that we didn't begin this process earlier. If we did begin this process earlier, I think today would be very different about the social angst happening in the street. I think what Sarah Chan says in her chapter is that bringing dialogue and reconciliation in the United States around racial issues are similar to her study of what happened with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. And I think that ultimately has shown that other countries, not just developed countries, have gone down this path and have succeeded in moving a nation and a people back together to heal past wounds. I just want to, before we leave this question, just mention parenthetically, I was in Rwanda for their 12th anniversary of their genocide. And the Rwandans also believed in this notion of reconciliation and had to move beyond the torture of the genocide of the Hutu and the Tutsis destroying each other. So again, not countries that are in the quote-unquote developed realm, but these are nations who have gone amok. And I think, you know, different parts of the world have shown us as a model why this is so critical. And I think it is timely. I think it fits into our sort of instructions that our authors have talked about in this book, that it's really time for the United States to set up a National Reconciliation Commission, and let's deal with this. Let's have testimony. Let's bring reconciliation let's bring compensation to the people whose ancestors toiled and were ripped from their moorings to come to a country that ultimately did them wrong.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Thank you. Those are very important words to hear at this time. And though I'd like to continue, I know we need to move on to part two. So could you relay the importance of the studies and stories in this section presented on youth education and also the voice of women?
Absolutely. So in this section, I mean, we talk about both youth and women and how both have been left off of the peacemaking tables after post-conflict. So we are critically this is a critical importance, and I think just some of the background of why we would even move in this direction. If we just think about young people, they're probably half the world's population and growing. And, you know, it's estimated that roughly 600 million youths live in, you know, fragile, conflict-prone societies. They and women continue to be marginalized and undervalued. And I think what we see is enough is enough. Youth movements are rising up around the world. I just point to climate change as a exemplar of what these mobilized youth abilities to really sort of bring questions to the fore. Fridays for the Future are school strikes sparked by Greta Thunberg, who, you know, is a 17 or 18-year-old brilliant and courageous woman. And I think there's been over 2,000 demonstrations in hundreds of countries now. And we see that over and over again to, you know, to where it is really the structure and really the emphasis of a youth voice and a woman's voice. We've seen women marching in the street as well for not only in the United States, not only for reproductive rights and for the fear that Roe v. Wade may be overturned by probably one jurist on the Supreme Court. And it's one vote away from probably having women go to back alleys for abortions. So, you know, again, enough is enough. And I think this notion of empowering women, empowering young people to speak their minds, to organize, to communicate through the internet, through, you know, social media, to bring that populace to a decision-making phenomenon so that the elected officials of the world, which are mostly, you know, white male, straight white male decision makers, are confronted with this reality. You can't be blind to populations who really are subjugated to the devastation of when peace goes awry. And again, I want to go back to Rwanda in this part too, because Rwanda is a very special case. the 1994 genocide against the Tutsi in particular, had in just 100 days had close to 1 million people dead. That's a phenomenal piece of data when you think about our soiled history, world history. And, you know, it's a very powerful chapter that talks about the turning to tribal courts. And in the indigenous language in Tutsi, I believe, it's called Gakaka. Gakaka are tribal courts that were set up by the Rwandan post-genocide government to try the perpetrators of the genocide. And when they actually began the process, it was very clear that the person who lived next to you, who might have macheted your child to death, is still living there. And how are you going to move beyond that? I mean, Western society is very clear, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. But, you know, turning to indigenous cultures and indigenous tribal courts, it's very different in the post-healing for a society like Rwanda. They couldn't afford official trials. The high-level officials were tried, but the lower, quote-unquote, the lower citizens who committed atrocities, they also had to be held accountable. And they were under the Kagakas. And it's this kind of formula that perhaps gives hope for the future of really how do we deal with, you know, other countries and other civilizations that go awry, and how does a post-genocide situation get repaired. One of the chapters, Enigre and Richards, they actually do some methodology in this chapter, which is very interesting. They take 18 to 22-year-old diverse socio-historical youths into who were born in a family with at least one parent survivor who was a perpetrator or a bystander. And out of that, they did six focus groups and interviews. And their findings was actually fascinating. They found that, you know, from their study that, you know, the youth wanted to push for more education and bring film and music and drama and sports to bring about unity and reconciliation. The interethnic, the issues of interethnic marriage also, you know, came out, you know, between the Hutu and the Tutsis. They wanted to move beyond that, much like we moved beyond the phobia of interracial marriage with Loving versus Virginia. And I think that notion is very clear. They also wanted policy changes on the governmental level to bring a new society forward. So these stories, and I think these studies really presented in this chapter, really do talk about a new voice that we've not paid tribute to. They've been around for eons, but I think with the internet, with organizing much easier through social media, they've been able to communicate with each other and ultimately use that as a way to communicate to the powers that be and bring a better society forward.
Thank you. This is wonderful. And again, I could speak all day on this, and they'll have to move to part three. And something that really stuck out to me was the reference in chapter 9, Women's Post-War Activism in Bosnia-Herzegovina, A Human Rights Approach to Peace Building and Reconciliation Through Liminal Space by Edin Ibrahim Mefendik and Randall Joy Thompson, on the close relationship between leaders and followers and the quote that followers created leaders. Could you speak on this reflection of Peace, Reconciliation, and Social Justice Leadership in the 21st Century, The Role of Leaders and Followers, and the Bond Between Leaders and Followers and the Making of Leaders by Followers?
So, you know, it is always a quandary of leadership studies that followers are left off the scale of discussion. And leaders, you know, I can go on for probably hours to talk about my disillusionment with leadership studies as a field, which has really blossomed over the last 40, 50 years. And I love one of my colleagues at Harvard, Barbara Kellerman, who wrote a book, The Death of Leaders. And you know, she basically says, okay, so we've had all these great leadership study disciplines in universities, and we've, you know, we have a whole industry of development for leaders in private sector, corporate settings, nonprofits. And then she opines in the book, do we really have better leaders after all these decades? And she comes out with basically the conclusion, no. So we have an industry, a complex, you know, a leadership development industry that ultimately has produced a lot of, you know, rhetoric and a lot of studies and a lot of discourse, but there's been very little substantive training of, you know, helping society as a whole move past its quandary of finding the search for better leaders. And so here comes the enigma that's, you know, the discussion of the intelligent, disobedient follower. You know, followers have an ability to ultimately become leaders. This is James McGregor Burns' formalistic way back in the 60s and 70s of talking about transformational leaders and ultimately how people, very few people like a Gandhi or a Martin Luther King could transform masses of people into their own leaders. Leaders should go away. People ultimately should become leaders. You know, Gandhi didn't want to keep leadership against the British as his solo pilot formula, his ego-driven formula. He really released the people of the country to become their own leaders through nonviolence. Same thing with Martin Luther King. The civil disobedience, civil rights movement in the United States, John Lewis being part of that, may he rest in peace. This is the way that leaders really should be departing their true leadership to the followers below them. So I think this notion of this chapter that you pulled out is very much cognizant that leaders and followers, leaders do create followers, and you know, the followers must become their own conscious leaders. And again, when leadership goes in the wrong direction, it's important for leaders to be, for followers to check leaders. In another book I wrote a few years ago, I interviewed Edward Hollander, who is the father of inclusive leadership. And Hollander said, what we really need is, he called it idiosyncratic credits. And I said, Dr. Hollander, what do you mean by idiosyncratic credits? He said, it's very simple. Think of a psychic bank where followers deposit credits for their leaders. And leaders go out and, you know, say things and do things. And, you know, people, the followers, allow these credits to build up. But when leaders don't deliver on their promises, or they don't build walls as they promised, or, you know, they don't save us from a pandemic, those credits then are like a psychic bank. get withdrawn by the followers. And I think, you know, this notion that Hollander was talking about was so cogent to the reality today that, you know, it's this relationship that followers really are check mechanisms for, you know, military units to police organizations, to other entities that really need to prevent leaders from doing right. I mean, supporting leaders to do right and preventing them from doing wrong. And this is, I think, the raison d'etre of this chapter and really this part three, because, you know, we're asking that, you know, to stop being sheep. And, you know, we have a culture of, you know, of conformity. And, you know, the Milligrand studies back in, I guess, the 40s and 50s, the Zimbardo studies about prisoners in his Stanford experiments shows that as a species, we believe authority is always right. And therefore, we take that, we believe and we follow. And we are regimented in our followership without, to a large degree, being the nonconformist, you know, raising the truth and the truth flag that ultimately should stop bogus and bad leadership. If Hitler had, you know, a followership that really sort of questioned the Third Reich and its notion of eugenics and taking people into concentration camps and exterminating everyone other than the Aryan race, whatever that is, you know, the war would have been won much sooner. Clearly, as the, you know, Nazis marched over Europe and, you know, tried to get into Russia, you know, we saw this mass conformity, this, you know, almost, you know, drinking from the same Kool-Aid of hysteria, where, you know, populism and nationalism collide with this, you know, charismatic leader that becomes, in times of going wrong, despotic. And I think we see it now in countries outside the United States, and I'll even say in the United States, where we now have to look at ourselves and say, what is our role as followers? Followership is not a bad term. It is, you know, somehow leadership studies has always elevated the leader. You know, we all want to be leaders. We all want to, you know, run the ship. Well, it's not simple as that. And I think when we stop and really reflect on our leadership conundrum, as Barbara Kellerman talks about, you know, we are at the end of our sort of rope of producing better leaders. And, you know, what are we teaching our students in, you know, graduate schools today in PhD studies about leadership? I mean, to me, it's, you know, it's the concentration only on the leadership side and not on the followership side.
Thank you. That's very important. And moving on to part four in the 16th chapter, Beyond Ubuntu, What the World Can Learn from Building Community from Africa. Can you please provide the audience a look into African models of leadership and peacebuilding practices as it relates to decolonizing peacebuilding, of which is noted at the beginning as a new discourse?
Sure. Well, let me start off with an African proverb, which I think is indicative of looking at Ubuntu and this notion of a African model of leadership and peace building. The African proverb goes as such, quote, "If you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together," unquote. I think this notion really sort of sums up Ubuntu, which is roughly translated as to something, "I am because you are. I am because you are." And it's really, Ubuntu is a meaning of really the quality of the human being. it manifests itself through various acts, and I think is clearly an African philosophy of building community and peace. And it's through a person is a person through others' eyes and through others' worldview. And the African proverb I quoted reveals a worldview that we are to, I think, bring selfhood to others, that we are first and foremost social beings, and that, if you will, no man or woman is an island. So as sort of Africans would believe is, one finger cannot pick up a grain. I love that. One finger cannot pick up a grain. Ubuntu is, at the same time, a deeply personal philosophy that calls on us to mirror humanity for each other. It's a traditional leadership practice that has been for centuries developed in Africa, and it's deeply relational. It places value on really the individual and the community, and it's building also in this chapter, in part four, Ubuntu is being examined through two sister organizations that have Pan-African philosophies of thinking about Ubuntu, the African Leadership Academy and the African Leadership University. Desmond Morris, I think, also sort of embodies this notion of his preaching of Ubuntu. And he said at one point, "My humanity is caught up and bounded in you." It's a connection really to also to, I think, if you stretch this a bit, it's not just a African leadership style. It's also, we can think about our own Western leadership development and some of the notions of how intelligent emotional intelligence has been developed as a field within the psyche of leaders. Emotional intelligence and is now something that the Harvard Business Report has been talking about. There's a global empathy index of the Fortune 500. And we're talking about leaders who stop thinking only about themselves and really translate their organizations first and foremost. And it's not some gratuitous formula. It's not some spurious entity that somehow is a tokenism of the other, but it's a true meaning that I think even CEOs today are starting to pay homage to. Corporate social responsibility efforts, and clearly the nonprofit sector, I think, understand Ubuntu in a Western formula, as we would understand it. But in the African sense, it's also healing old wounds. It's also, these wounds caused in part by colonial, post-colonial, globalized society today, which, in a large degree, globalism has, as we can see with the pandemic, has, really exposed the haves and the have-nots of what the liberal, neoliberal economic model coming from the Chicago School has really developed into. And I think it creates also, Ubuntu creates also a story. It creates a platform for storytelling. And it mobilizes collective action in the process. And I just remember one of our greatest presidents, President Lincoln, was a phenomenal storyteller. He gave orders to his generals fighting a civil war by telling stories. And this is the kind of leadership that Ubuntu talks about, because African storytelling is also an oral history that tells one generation to another about you know, what it was like and where were we going in the future, inclusive in the past. And I think Mbutu is really that formalistic way that Africans have a way to really teach the Western society about what do we think about for future reconciliation and healing our wounds and ultimately moving past our discourse within the current reality.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. And last, I know that there has been a lot covered, but do you have any additional thoughts that you would like to bestow upon our audience and how this important source can teach us as a global human race and society, as followers and leaders, use our individual and collective actions to alleviate toxic political climates, human rights abuses, and smaller to larger systems of injustice?
So in the introduction, my colleagues and I talked about we look back and we thought, wow, this is a massive field. And we're seeing it through the lens of leaders and followers. And if we talk about peace and reconciliation and social justice through that lens, what's missing? And again, we found, I think, maybe the juggernaut of what's missing. And it's not the key, but I think it's a key to further discussions that ultimately, I think, transgress into many of the points I raised in this interview. And in the introduction, we talk about the decoloniality of leadership, decolonializing leadership as a subset of really thinking deeply about what are we missing? What is the variable that ultimately we don't understand? And let me just for the audience take a moment and just, you know, talk a bit about decoloniality, because I think before you can talk about decolonializing leadership, you first have to take a step back. So, you know, it principally emerged from a lot of the Latin American movements focusing on critical indigenous methodologies. And you know, I can talk about the Zapatista movement for self-government out of the hegemony of Mexico, or the landless workers movement in Brazil. But it was a response ultimately to decolonializing of the global South and the cultural, social, political domination of European Western penetration that colonialism, imperialism, and now globalism has ultimately brought forward. And I think eliminating these sort of Western European models of thinking for, you know, people, not only in the global South, but also in the global North. These challenges ultimately talk about, you know, this, that modernity itself is really a falsity, because it's a colonial modernity that we are inheriting, as globalization, I think, has shown us. So that as a sort of premise, I think what we are arguing in the introduction that sets the framework for the book is that, you know, we need to decolonialize leadership theory and peace building, and ultimately think about that for future research and examination. And decoloniality is really a positive disruptor with new voices of indigenous followers. And I hate to quote myself, but I will in the introduction, because it's a short quote, and I think it sums up what I want to say. So bear with me. The quote is in the introduction: "The importance of decolonialization of our thinking around peace, conflict resolution, reconciliation, and social justice, especially as it pertains to leadership and followership theory and practice, is the praxis of this volume. The logic of decolonialization is simple yet complex. It involves the intense lived experience of those at both ends of the modernity-coloniality complex. It challenges the dominant global capital world order from the voyages of the 15th century European explorers to the ossification of the post-Cold War neoliberal globalization process that has left its scarred legacy in post-colonial classification of class, gender, sexuality, masculinity, femininity, gay, straight, transgender identities, and power relations between the global North and global South. Behind the veil of the struggles between development versus underdevelopment, exploited versus exploiter, decolonialization puts a laser focus on the intersectionality of war, genocide, and the systems that create epistemicide, the annihilation of indigenous knowledge for a global North-centric reality. Decolonialization offers a counter-narrative to the global North-centric hegemonic social, political, economic structures and might be the juggernaut preventing a lasting peace. It also allows us to overcome stigmata, polarization, resentment, and it moves us closer to promote relationships of trust, inclusion, and equality. If the narratives of those most impacted by conflict are not brought into the post-healing process, can we ever move past a pseudo-peace? As the chapters in this book demonstrate, bringing forward the strength and resilience of survivors, peacemakers, and human rights defenders can bring agency for healing and empowerment. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Eric Schachman. That was a perfect quote. And I really appreciate you giving us an in-depth look into peace, reconciliation, and social justice leadership in the 21st century, the role of leaders and followers. And if possible, before we end, could you provide the audience a bit on what you're currently researching or working on at this time?
Sure. I'm working now with my colleagues in Chile, where I just spent my sabbatical before the COVID pandemic forced me to come back earlier. But we're looking at the interesting formula of exceptionalism within both Chile and the United States, and this whole notion of what does exceptionalism mean, both in a Latin American context and within the U.S. context. And we're beginning our journey towards interviewing a lot of the decision makers, not only in the Chilean motif, but also in the U.S. Decision-making order. So it's been a fascinating journey to think about how this fall from grace of other nations who also, and empires who practice exceptionalism, the Romans, the Greeks, the Byzantine, the British, and, you know, what exceptionalism is both a myth and a reality. And we've started to explore that as our investigations that I think will prove very fertile in giving us a new pointer in looking especially at U.S. Foreign policy and Latin American foreign policy.
Thank you. And I look forward to hearing more about that in the future. And I want to thank you so much, Dr. Eric Schachman, for being on the New Books Network and for providing our audience wisdom on peace, reconciliation, and social justice leadership in the 21st century, the role of leaders and followers. I've really enjoyed our time.
Same here. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And stay safe, everybody.